This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Hugh McCall joins us later this hour to talk about Charlotte, its future, leadership, and more. But first, we welcome back novelist Charles Frazier. He is the best-selling author of Cold Mountain, a National Book Award winner, which was also made into an Oscar-winning film. That book was set in the Civil War era Blue Ridge Mountains and follows a Confederate soldier in the aftermath of that conflict. Frazier says he never thought he'd write about that period again, but he was wrong. His latest book, Verena, is an historical novel about the First Lady of the Confederacy, Verena Davis, wife of Jefferson Davis. Charles Frazier says he felt compelled to write about this complicated woman who found herself on the wrong side of history but was determined to forge a new path forward for herself. Charles Frazier, welcome back.
Good to be here. Hi.
By the way, Mr. Frazier is reading from his book, speaking, and also signing books tonight at 7 at Lorraine Mill in Gastonia. We'll have details about that on our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Given that Cold Mountain, your debut novel, was so enormously successful, both as a book and a film, and that the book attracted international attention, why did you think that you'd finished writing about the Civil War period in American history?
Well, that book took a long time to write and a long time to research.
How long is a long time?
I'm kind of done.
How long is a long time?
Oh, I think I worked on that book for something like 8 years, give or take.
Is that because it was a first novel and you wanted it to be, perfect?
Yeah, and I didn't go to an MFA program or anything like that. I was learning how to write a novel as I wrote it.
Wow, you taught English for a long period of time. I know you taught at NC State for a while.
Yeah.
So, but just teaching English doesn't make you a novelist, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's kind of different writing one than reading one.
So, how long did Verena take?
I think I worked about 5 years on this.
Wow.
Yeah.
And there have been other novels in between the first one and this one.
Right.
There are those who say, well, you say, that we're still fighting the Civil War today. And you can see it in the difficult conversations we have about race, about monuments, about which way the country is headed. The Civil War, I think, is echoed in the different views that people have in rural and urban America. As you have looked at that era of American history for these two books, do you think you've come away with any insight on that time that could help us understand ourselves better today and move us towards some resolution of conflict?
Well, I'm convinced that we've never resolved the issues that caused the war. Issues of race, the legacy of slavery in the South and in the North, and the failures of Reconstruction. There was a woman came through the signing line a couple of nights ago who put it much more succinctly than I can. She said, for a wound to heal, you've got to clean it out first.
Hmm. And you're not alone in that. We talked about, I'm trying to remember his name, rats. Not Robert Morgan. We talked to a person down in, I think, Mississippi who is working on the memorial to lynchings. And he says that you have to tell the truth and you before you can reconcile. You have to acknowledge what came before you can move forward. And you're saying essentially the same thing.
Yeah. Forgetting history, covering up history, however you ignore it, I think is not helpful. It's important to understand, and I think that I hope I'm going to be able to go by that monument this week in Alabama.
Okay.
And visit it. It looks very powerful. The photographs I've seen.
Was that the goal behind this book, to explore some of those themes?
Well, Verena was such a complicated person, and her life was so unexpected, and it just, as I learned more about her, felt like she was a good way into that dialogue. I see historical fiction as having as much to do with the present as the past, and she gave me a way to move into that world, you know, from this world.
Who was the real Verena Howell Davis before she met and married Jefferson Davis?
She was the daughter of her father was a his father, her grandfather, was an 8-term governor of New Jersey, and her mother was from a pretty wealthy family in Mississippi. So she grew up very well educated. Generally, throughout her life, she was better educated than the men she was around. Mm. She was also tall. She had sort of olive-colored skin, and that was cause for a lot of gossip in Richmond over the years. And she was witty. She was sharp-tongued. A lot of people found her too opinionated. She was kind of too everything for a lot of, to fit that Southern 19th-century stereotype of an ideal politician's wife.
Hmm. This is historical fiction, and some people who have engaged in particularly movies based on historical fiction have come under the spotlight because people say, well, that's not really what happened. How, when you do a piece of historical fiction and you're writing about real people, but you're writing about them in a fictional way, what kind of obligation do you feel you have either to history and accuracy and the person that you're writing about? Versus creating a really good fiction novel.
Well, I mean, for me, the fiction is always driving the car, but I do keep a framework of facts. There are loads and loads and loads of things that really happened in this book, but sometimes I'm interpreting them the way I see them. That may be a little different from some of the history books. But I keep that that skeleton of fact.
And you say you felt compelled to write about Verena Davis. Jefferson Davis is scarcely in this book.
Yeah.
Why did you feel compelled to write about her, and why is he so a ghost-like presence in this book?
Well, I'm glad you expressed it that way. I was aiming for that. That was the hardest part of the book, is how to deal with him, because I've never been interested in him. But I read a lot of contemporary stuff about him, people who knew him and how they described him, and he was not enormously well liked by a lot of people. The one that I kept in mind, the line I kept in mind, was from Sam Houston, who was in the U.S. Senate with Jefferson Davis, and he said, "Davis is as cold as a lizard and as ambitious as Lucifer."
So she wasn't.
So that was kind of my model for him.
Yeah. So she wasn't well liked, and he wasn't well liked. Is this a coupling made in heaven?
Well, people either really liked her or didn't like her.
Did they like each other?
Well, they had 6 children, so at times they did. They also spent a lot of time apart and quarreling quarreling over his will and about the aftermath of the war. She lived in London for a good long stretches of time by herself after the war.
Hmm. People back then wrote letters, and we have those to go by. So did you read those letters as background for this work? How much do we know about her real-life relationship with Jeff Davis and her influence or lack of influence on him?
Well, there are lots of his letters available, and a good many of hers, but their courtship letters, her side of it, went missing during the Civil War. And she frequently signed her letters and then at the end wrote, "Burn after reading." So some people actually followed directions.
As a teenager, you say that she had limited marriage prospects, and so she married a widower, Jefferson Davis, a wealthy Mississippi plantation owner, twice her age. Why were her prospects limited?
Her father had come down from New Jersey and started a bunch of different businesses and investments and that kind of thing, and went bankrupt down in Natchez, and so she was not as desirable a partner as she had been when she was younger.
But they met, I think, at a party, and it was, for her at least, it was love at first sight. She liked him, at least back then. But on their honeymoon, is it true, they went and visited his first wife's grave? That's what happened?
Yeah, that was part of the festivities.
She had a front row seat to history, but you would imagine that she didn't have much say in that history. When you look at her, and what she talked about later in life with regard, and we'll talk about this, but with regard to the Confederacy and her husband's presidency of that ill-fated effort, could it be said that she was a victim of circumstances, or did she give her husband and the cause her full-throated support while it was underway?
She didn't give him full-throated support. She was very much against secession. But she was. She also benefited from the slave economy for the first half of her life, and in the book she says, you know, that was a moment in history that called for taking a side, and at some point history asks, which side were you on, and she was on the wrong one.
Is that what makes her interesting to you, that she was, you know, in a way trapped by her husband's decisions and spent the rest of her life trying to disentangle herself from that life and those decisions?
Well, what interested me is that when most Southerners connected with the Confederacy, you know, involved in the leadership, were, and a lot of other people too, were digging in and you know, establishing the Jim Crow period and all that, and talking about the lost cause, that she moved to New York City and said she, you know, she never went back to the South. Mm-hmm. And she seemed to be a person trying to live in the present time and adapt to the present time, not entrench herself in the past and glorify it.
You talked a second ago about her being on the wrong side of history. Yeah. Is that something that she said about herself, or can you extrapolate that from the things she actually did say about that?
Yeah, one thing she did say was, and she said this very publicly, the right side won the war.
Wow.
Which did not make her real popular in the South.
And yet they invited her to live in Richmond free after in her older age. Why were they so magnanimous towards somebody who said the right side won?
Well, that move to New York didn't go over well, and they found a house and said she could live in it, for the rest of her life, and she said no. And she was in New York, being friends with Julia Grant, the widow of Ulysses S. Grant, and you know, they went on a couple of vacations together and had regular carriage rides in Central Park, and that, of course, didn't go well. She was seen having a long conversation with Booker T. Washington in a hotel lobby about education, and that was widely criticized in the South.
Charles Frazier is the author of Verena, which is the historical fictional novel about Verena Davis, the wife of Jefferson Davis. It's a second Civil War novel. His first was Cold Mountain, but in between there was 13 Moons and Nightwoods, and he's in town tonight to speak at the Luray Mills in Gastonia. We'll come back and talk more about how he approached writing this story on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Charles Frazier, a best-selling author. His book, Cold Mountain, became an Oscar-winning movie, and now he's out with his fourth novel, Verena, which is historical fiction based on the life of Verena Davis, the wife of Confederate President Jefferson Davis. We talked a minute ago about how she had said, in real life, the real Verena Davis said that the right side won the war. And when secession was about to happen, I think this is true, she told friends, at least you say that she says, my husband is going to be the president and it's going to be a disaster.
She said that.
What did she mean by that? Was it because that he wasn't up to the job, or that the South wasn't equipped to win?
Well, it may have been both those things. She thought that that politics was not really his best talent, that he had this way of making policy decisions based on who he was mad at, who he felt had been loyal or disloyal to him, that kind of thing.
Well, this sounds familiar.
yeah, it kind of does.
After the war was over, and I guess there was a period of time when both he and she were escaping separately through the South. They both came through Charlotte, as a matter of fact. Yeah. She ended up living with Jefferson Davis in Mississippi until he died when she was around 60 years old. And then she moved, as you said, to New York City. How do you handle that life transition in the novel?
Well, she finished his memoirs that he was working on when he died, and moved. And the thing that interested me is that she moved to become a writer. She was 61, I think, at that time, and went to work for the New York World newspaper, which was a Pulitzer paper, and made a good chunk of her living doing it for a while.
That seems to me to be highly unusual for that time period for a newspaper to hire a woman to write. What was she writing about?
Yeah, she did columns, for a little while she did like an early version of a Dear Abby advice column, etiquette and that kind of thing.
And did they make much of the fact that she was Verena Davis, or was it fundamentally based on her talents and abilities?
A little bit of both. She occasionally wrote columns about. Like there's one that's sort of Christmas at the Confederate White House, but she also did a lot of other things fairly unrelated.
And this friendship that you referenced a minute ago, her friendship with the widow of Ulysses S. Grant, which was public, as you say,
yeah.
They went out together. Was that deliberately public? Was it a way for her to essentially telegraph that, we need to heal these wounds. I've healed this wound, and you can too. Or was this simply that they liked each other, and she was living in the North, so there are probably limited repercussions to her personally for having this friendship. Yeah. What was the motivation there?
Well, I think they genuinely liked each other. Newspapers in the South said, "How could they possibly have anything in common?" But they had a great deal in common. They liked each other, but they also saw their friendship as an example of reconciliation. So they wanted to be noticed and be in the newspapers for having lunch together.
Hmm. Several years ago on this program, I spoke with Bertram Hayes Davis, who is Jefferson Davis's great-grandson, who says that Davis knew that slavery was not sustainable and that he was not really an advocate for it, and yet he willingly accepted an appointment to be the president of the Confederacy. He wasn't elected, he was appointed. And what do we know about Verena's views on slavery at the time of secession and the war?
Not much. You have to kind of infer them from other things, such as her stating that she was against secession. And things she said afterwards. I mean, she was not. I didn't see her as a hero when I started this book. I didn't see her as a hero afterwards. She never reached a position on those issues that we would be comfortable with. The thing that interested me was the movement she continued to try to make in her later years. She continued to evolve in her thinking and her feeling about those issues at a time in life when a lot of people are just kind of clenching up and holding on to those values of their youth.
One of the ways you do that in this book to demonstrate her evolving views is through this character, Jimmy, James Limber, I think his real name was, and he was a real person. He's a young boy when she was in the Confederate White House, what, 5-6 years old?
Yeah,
there are photographs of him. You can look them up on Google, and that's because she had him photographed with the family. And when the Confederacy fell, she took this young boy with her. Why?
Well, it's something of a mystery. I mean, I didn't know anything about this child, this multiracial child living in the Confederate White House alongside Jefferson Davis's children. He disappears from history shortly after she was captured. And I wanted, the more I got into the book, I began thinking what could have happened to that child? What kind of life might he have had? And I invented a life for him, and he comes to find her at the very beginning of the book to ask, am I that child who lived in the Confederate White House? It would explain some of the flashes of memory I have from early childhood.
And
I thought it would give a good, the structure of the book is there Sunday conversations over a seven weeks.
Yeah, because they at some point she's talking about her memories of that time and how she wishes we could go back. I'm going to paraphrase. She wishes she could go back to a time when people got along, when they liked each other and took care of each other.
Yeah. Yeah. She actually said that, and she would say something very progressive one day and then something like that a week later. And I as James Blake, the grown-up Jimmy Limber, mm-hmm. Gets to know her better, he becomes bolder in challenging her on those kinds of statements.
He pricks her consciousness.
Yeah.
Kind of. Your book, though historical, does not follow a linear timeline. It jumps around. And you've said that you wanted it to be driven more by memory than by the calendar. It's a pattern that a lot of TV shows and movies are using now. What is not following a linear timeline, going back and forth in time to different periods of time, allow you to do as a writer?
Well, given that a lot of the book involves her memory and James Blake's memory or lack of it, I wanted to use what felt like a more natural, reconstruction of the past that most people I know when they're telling a story are constantly circling back around, oh, this other thing I need to tell as context for the thing I started telling. So I do some of that. I tried to use some time cues and things like that to help the reader negotiate those jumps.
Well, I was going to ask you how, because sometimes people don't like that because they're used to this linear, this timeline. How do you help them through the book?
Well, the present time of the book is 1906. All of those sections are written in present tense. They're at the same location. James Blake is a grown man. And then there are the sections that she calls the axle of her life, those 5 or 6 mm-hmm. weeks when she was fleeing Richmond trying to get to Cuba. And you know when they're on the road, she's out there on the road with a bunch of little kids, fleeing, you're going to come back to that, circle back to that period. And then the rest of her memories kind of float a little more with her thoughts and feelings of that particular day.
Do we know why she and Jefferson Davis fled Richmond separately, or at least at some point separated in their escape?
Yeah, she left about 3 days before Richmond burned. He was gonna hang in there as long as possible. He also kind of thought he was gonna maybe get on the west side of the Mississippi and regroup some troops over there and keep fighting a guerrilla war or mm-hmm. some kind of resistance over there, and finally gave those plans up.
You know, we all know about Mary Todd Lincoln, President Lincoln's wife. We know about her activities in the White House while he was president. She wasn't particularly well-liked by the press or the public either. We know about her struggles. We know how Lincoln struggled to help her through her bouts of what was then called melancholy, and we know what happened to her after his assassination. Why do we know so little about Verena Davis? I'd never heard her name before this book came up.
You know, I don't know whether I had either. I imagine I had seen it, but it didn't register with me. So I had no idea of how complex her life was. And felt that she was She was an unknown enough quantity to give me some latitude to work with, and the known parts of her life were fascinating to me, and so she made a good source for a fictional character.
Mary Chestnut, who we all know from the Ken Burns Civil War series, I guess she was a prolific letter writer about her time in the Civil War. She also plays a role in this book. She writes to Verena, correct?
Yeah.
Did they know each other?
They did. Yeah, they were both young, much younger wives of older politicians, and they met in Washington when they were about 18, I think. During the war, Mary Chestnut was a frequent visitor to the White House. I mean, as in almost daily when she was in town. And there was lots of gossip about them. You know, people were curious why they were together so much during the war. The society ladies of Richmond criticized just about everything Verena did.
Are there parallels to the lives of the two first ladies, Mary Todd Lincoln and Verena Davis? Because there seem to be some parallels between Jefferson Davis and Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, they may have met when they were young men during the Black Hawk War. I think that sense of being criticized, being scrutinized constantly, and criticized for everything that anybody found outside this very rigid set of boundaries of the behavior expected from politicians' wives. Mm-hmm. They definitely both suffered from that. Verena had periods of depression, usually related to losing a child, very understandably depressed. But they also shared a dressmaker.
Really? Yeah. Well, she lived in Washington for a while too, because her husband was a congressman loved evidently society life in Washington.
Yeah, some people called her during that period of time. Jefferson was a congressman, the senator, and then Secretary of War, and she loved giving parties, going to parties, and people called her. Some people called her Queen Verena. Hmm. Some called her that in admiration. Some called her that because they thought she was maybe a little too bright and witty and kind of a leader of society when they thought her manners were a little bit too crude and Western, as they put it.
And Western in those days did not mean California or even
right.
Texas.
Yeah, it was Mississippi, Alabama.
Yeah, you say that
the
shape of her life, you say, was a saw blade, jagged and dangerous from end to end. Why do you describe her that way?
Yeah. Well, I mean, just early on, I was probably just kind of charting out the key components of her life. And realized that there were there wasn't some typical plot chart line of the rising action, the falling action, etc. There were these rising and falling, moments of achievement and loss, and really good times and horrible times that kind of went all the way through. She had six kids. Only one survived to reproduce.
Mm. In this novel, in Verena, in thinking and talking about the Civil War, she talks about people who would vote out God. This is a quote from the book. Vote out God in favor of the devil if he fed them back their hate and fear in a way that made them feel righteous. Is that based on something that she actually said? Or are those words that you've put into her mouth not only because of other things she said at the time in her life, but because of what you see happening around us today?
Well, probably both of those things. I mean, she didn't say those words. I was going from some things she said and trying to develop her thoughts and feelings about about their culpability, about their loss, about their guilt toward the latter parts of her life.
Because that sounds very much like something that could be said, or and is probably being said in some quarters by some people about what's going on today. Before you wrote Verena, after Cold Mountain, you said you were done writing about the Civil War.
Yeah.
You think you're done now?
Well, you know, I may have to eat these words. I think I am.
Because you never know. The muse strikes and you have to do it, right?
Yeah.
Is that how
yeah.
it works?
Yeah, and you know, in the events of this this past few years, when you think about the church shootings in Charleston and the violence in Charlottesville, it just felt like that war continues to influence our not just our history but our culture and our present day.
Do you think reading this book and looking at what she goes through and the journey that she takes to wrestle not just with her life but some of the things that happened in her life and what she participated in and in her conversations with Jimmy that prick her consciousness, do you think that this can help people come to a better understanding of what the truth is so that we can move forward? Can that be done through fiction?
Well, I think it can certainly contribute to that. I think the complexities and the nuances of our country's history of race and the legacy of slavery, has to be known, dealt with, examined, thought about. All of that.
Charles Frazier, author of Verena, Cold Mountain, 13 Moons, and Nightwoods. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHA. Mike Collins. Last Friday was the 20th anniversary of this program, and Hugh McCall joined us for a little celebration. Mr. McCall is former CEO and chairman of the Bank of America and grew that bank from a small North Carolina enterprise into one of the most important financial institutions in the country. Concurrently, he was also building Charlotte. His vision and influence were profound, and today much of what you see uptown is due to him. So I asked him, what was more satisfying, building the bank or the city?
Well, Mike, without question, building the city is what really matters to me. I enjoyed the bank. I really love the people at the bank, but I haven't really missed the bank or the power. I really enjoy making things happen, and so I love the city. This is what I really love.
And you're from Bennettsville, so what is it about Charlotte that speaks? I mean, God knows when you came to Charlotte, there was nothing here. So what is it about that?
Yeah. Well, of course, I always said you could fire a shotgun down the street at 5 o'clock and never hit a damn person on it. It was the most boring town anybody could ever go to, but we had a lot of churches and no whiskey. You couldn't dance to live music, you remember? We had a lot of good laws like that. And anyway, I had to have a job. So that's why I came to Charlotte.
And what prepared you in your background or as a young person in the banking business that made you able to take this little local bank, NCNB, the best bank in the neighborhood, and build it into the largest bank in the nation?
I think, seriously, we hated being little. I've been little my whole life. It's really a difficult thing to be. I think what really got me started on it, one time I was reading the Bank of America's report for the year, and they had earned more money than the size of my company. And so at that point, I realized we were going to have to do something about that. I was also a Southerner, and I was really very much a Southerner, and I disliked the fact that the Yankees had all the good business down here, and we weren't big enough to handle the big clients, and so we set out to build something that could compete, and I think we accomplished that.
And I think you've been on the show in the studio several times, and you used to drop by. You're welcome to come by anytime you'd like to. Yeah. But you used to drop by after the show to tell me all the things you wanted to say, but you couldn't remember the phone number. And during one of those conversations that we had, your wife was with you, and the story was told about how you acquired Bank America in San Francisco. Yeah. And how you went out there, and they thought this was going to be a merger kind of equals, but they were going to maintain the top dog status. Mm. You had other ideas.
Well, I think the Bank of America, really, the people running it, thought we were bumptious barbarians and sort of underestimated the game they had gotten in. And so it didn't work like they thought it would.
In fact, isn't it true that you made sure that they couldn't take the bank back?
Well, we actually, yes. In the merger agreement, there was a penalty for breaking off, and it was $25 billion, and that usually discourages people from breaking off of they did try to get out of the merger at one point, and I had to fly back across the world to try to save it. And I can't resist telling the story because I've flown all the way from Prague back to San Francisco to have this meeting, to have him tell me that he wanted to break off. And while I was in the air, he found out from the lawyers he couldn't. He didn't want to meet with me in the bank, so he said, let's meet in the park. So we go to the park. We're sitting on a park bench, and we're talking, and a street person comes up, and he looks at the both of us, and he says to me, aren't you Hugh McCall? Now, I'm in San Francisco. And a street person, he further says, I've always wanted to meet you. And I say, this is the chairman of the Bank of America, and he doesn't even look at him. So I think that's when they knew the music had stopped. Yeah. That's a true story.
They asked me at the station to talk to you. Since this program has been on for 20 years, we've seen a lot of growth and change and development in Charlotte over the last 20 years. Much of it you set the stage for and are responsible for and still play a key role behind the scenes in a lot of this. So in the past 20 years, what has happened in Charlotte that particularly pleased you or that you didn't think could happen that did happen, and what has depressed you?
Well, I think it's very rare anything happens that I don't think can happen. But I think the success of the light rail has been really exciting, and it's brought a whole new breed of cat to town. We've got lots of young people that are making things happen. They love living on the railroad. And I think the Northern Line will do wonders for us, and I think we should, you know, keep building. I mean, I'm for getting a private sector partner and continuing to build trains out to Mooresville and out to Matthews and out to Monroe and all this. We need to do it now. And the advantage I see in doing that would be that you get them to build it, you lease it back for 100 years, and you get four generations to pay for it instead of one generation trying to pay for it. And that makes more sense to me. But if you said, what am I disappointed about? I think I'm disappointed that we've become very large and that we, the quote Charlotte way, candidly is too slow. We've got problems we're not dealing with rapidly enough. And we are in the process and we are making good progress, but, you know, I'm always in a hurry.
Charlotte likes to think of itself as a bright and shining bubble. But we have serious problems. The social capital survey that came out several years ago showed that we don't know each other. The upward mobility study showed that if you're born poor in Charlotte, you will die poor in Charlotte. And I know that you made a decision to devote your remaining time to Charlotte's black community. You were very disturbed by the events that occurred after the Keith Scott shooting. So do you think that all these things that I've just talked about, are we at some sort of a watershed moment in Charlotte where we have to do something or the consequences will not be pretty?
Well, of course, I do believe that, but I think we are doing something. But as you know, one of the first things we've done that really makes a lot of sense is we've elected a brand new mayor and five or six new council people who are young and very diverse group of people. And I think they are energetically looking at these issues we have. And so from the governmental side, I think we have the right people in place and we have the impetus to do things. And then I think in the private sector, I think there's a great deal of effort underway at the moment, in particular in workforce housing, affordable housing, in child development centers. We see that being done by the private sector, by churches, and by, we now know the city is looking at this very seriously. And finally, the thing that's really important is to take a man out of poverty is to give him a job. And so one of the things that I know that Brian Monahan at the Bank of America is doing is heading up a corporate CEO group that is making it their main focus is training and jobs. In other words, getting companies to commit to taking X number of people every year, train them, and give them a job. So when we're going at it full force. So I'm encouraged by all of that. So,
but when it was you and, to a degree, Ed Crutchfield and Bill Lee and Rolf Neal, all the guys making the decisions and making things happen, well, at least leading the way, it was a different kind of leadership. It was corporate top-down leadership. And you've told me in the past that those days are over. And I know that you supported, in the last city council election, Braxton Winston, who was a demonstrator at the Keith Lamont Scott disturbances, and you supported Dimple Ashmira, two young millennial leaders. Why did you choose to support them?
Well, because I like them. They're smart, and both of them are smart, and they energetic, and I think they can make a difference. And I think that's what we need. I want to make one thing clear. I mean, I think the most important force at work in the United States today, including Charlotte, is really the women's movement, and the women's groups drove the election of these young people. It was driven by both white women and black women. Their organizations really were the ones that put forth the effort to elect this new council. And I think they're going to make a huge difference in the midterm elections in this country.
Braxton said that you had some uncomfortable conversations. The two of you had uncomfortable conversations together. Why were they uncomfortable?
I asked him why, you know, why the black community would not report crime in their neighborhood to the police. So that, and he gave me his reasons and his on that subject, and that led us to have many more lunches to talk about that. And in words, the lack of trust on the part of the black community, that they don't trust the police. And so, and I was telling him that was something we all observed, and we didn't understand it. But anyway, he and I've gotten to know each other, and I understand a whole lot about that.
Well, I know that when you told him you were going to support him, you said, "And you better win."
Yes, sir.
No pressure there.
No, but I mean, I really don't like losing. It's like, you know, why would you like losing? Nobody likes losing. But anyway, yeah, I told him that. And if you think about our council, it's very diverse, and it reflects the population of our city. It's no longer a bunch of old white men. It's really a very diverse group of people. And I think that's good for the city.
Let's talk about something else that we face. We face new ownership at the Panthers. Yeah. How important are the Panthers?
Well, the Panthers are really important. And I think we have been inundated with opinions from people who absolutely don't know what the hell they're talking about. And it's stunning to me that the league loves Charlotte. Charlotte's one of the fastest growing cities in America. It's one of the big TV markets in America. We have a great stadium. We've actually had 4 days out of 20 years in which it was really a miserable afternoon at the stadium. In other words, it's rained twice and snowed twice. But the truth of the matter, we got a great stadium. You've got a good team. And the new owner's going to love Charlotte. We just need to quit falling all over ourselves worrying about it.
Yeah, but what if the new owner comes in and says, I want a new stadium, or I want to put it down in South Carolina or something like that?
Well, it'd be interesting if he says that. I would think that the league, I think you have to actually understand the way the league operates. The league likes being in Charlotte. The other teams like being in Charlotte. And so we don't really have anything to worry about there.
Okay.
Where are they going? Yeah. Seriously. So I think we shouldn't get all bent out of shape about that. What we should be more interested in is what are we going to get Leon and Jerry to do to help the city. So this is what really matters. Where does the $2.5 billion go?
You've known Jerry Richardson for a really long time. I think, were you not the loan officer at whatever the predecessor to Bank of America was at the time,
yeah,
that lent him the money to start his Hardee's franchise?
Well, I think he actually got $10,000 from his partner's brother-in-law, and I loaned him $25,000 to build the first one here in Charlotte, which was over there on King's Drive. Mm-hmm. And then it went on, and eventually I loaned him $250,000, then later $250 million, and then $400 million for the team. You know, we've done business for a long time. But the good news, he's always paid us back.
Yes. You very sit in the client owner's box for the games. I know that because I watch him on television, and I think, darn, he's got a good seat. What do you think happened there?
I don't really have an opinion. You know, I think that one should avoid having opinions unencumbered by facts. And I'm unencumbered by the facts of the matter.
Let me just, let's pretend that it's 1980 or 1990, and you're still at the top of the tower, and you're looking out as the story in the Observer once said, you looked out with people in the office and saying, you see that land over there? That's where such and such is going to be. You see that over there? That's going to be the new arena. If you were at the top of the tower today and you were looking out, what would your vision for the city be?
Well, I think that what Kathy Bassant is working on, which is the North Tryon, let's call it north of where we're sitting, I think I would love to see that continue to grow and prosper, which would be a combination of office and housing. I think we will continue to grow up the north end of the town, and I think we should work hard on putting pocket parks there and, you know, making it livable, not just dense, but livable. And so I see that. And I've still got one more parking lot I'm still looking at, and that's the one by the First Presbyterian Church. I've been talking to them for 40 years about doing something there, and I'd like to see that happen before I die. And so I'm still working on that.
Well, I want to thank you for doing this tonight, because you didn't have to, and I'm not sure why you did, but I surely do appreciate it.
Yeah, I just like getting to talk to you. So that's why I did that.
Anytime. Thank you again. Appreciate it.